This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm reading again from Wrong Tree by Jeff Wilson, illustrated by Terry Dalton, his wife, and published by Cornerstone Press, Stevens Point. The subtitle is Adventures in Wildlife Biology. This book is a treat. I'll be reading about Bear Ecology 101. After we scraped the snow away from the den entrance with a small shovel, Jack said to me, "I guess this one's all yours, Jeff. It's too deep and narrow for me to even get my shoulders in." We tied a rope around my leg, and I wormed my way down the tunnel on my elbows. My head brushed the top of the tunnel, and my shoulders rubbed along its sides. I was pushing the syringe pole ahead of me with one hand, following the beam of my headlamp. I could hear a low buzzing sound, a bit like the buzzing of a swarm of bees. I had heard the sound before. It was the sound bear cubs make when they are suckling. When I could see the sow, I lifted the syringe pole, aimed it at her hip, and carefully inserted the needle and delivered the drug. I then kicked my roped leg up and down, the signal for Jack to pull me out. I emerged into the winter cold, feeling it afresh after being in the warmth of the den, and we sat down to wait the required 7 minutes for the drug to take effect. When the clock had ticked down, I crawled in again, attached a second rope to the sow, and gathered up the three cubs. This routine was a regular protocol for me during several years when I occasionally assisted in bear research projects, trying to tease out data on Wisconsin black bear reproduction and population dynamics. Den visits were only part of the work, but they were certainly a highlight. Like people, bears are fiercely protective of their young and parent their offspring for longer than many mammals. Like human children, bear cubs play roughhouse and make a lot of mistakes when they are adolescents. However, unlike most people, bears only have sex during one time of year, and the males do not help bring up the kids. In fact, they can be a significant threat to the cubs. The adult female, or sow, breeds every other year, coming into estrus fertility between the middle of June and the middle of July. During that time, adult males are really on the prowl, seeking to breed as many females as possible. Bruce Cohn found that our Wisconsin females can breed at 3.5 years of age, unlike in some other states where bears don't commonly breed until much older. Wisconsin also has a very prolific bear population. We know this because when a Wisconsin hunter registers a bear, a tooth is extracted from the carcass. Researchers cross-section that tooth and count the annual layers of dentine, which form rings, somewhat like the annual rings in the trunk of a tree. In years when a female bear is suckling cubs, the ring is thinner because much of the available calcium is going into milk to feed the cubs. These changes in annual tooth rings allow researchers like Bruce to learn a female bear's reproductive history, as well as her age, from a single tooth. The data from tooth aging, along with other factors, is critical to the Wisconsin DNR bear population model. Another fascinating aspect of Cohn's work was his data on bear weights. During his study, he caught 312 different bears 831 times and often recorded their weights. He found that they lost and gained pounds at a remarkable rate and that individuals varied. He had one 2-year-old male that weighed only 36 pounds, a real runt. Another male went from 140 pounds on June 3rd to a whopping 290 on September 7th, a gain of around 150 pounds in 2 months. During breeding season, mid-June to mid-July, some males clearly put romance above eating. One example was a manly bear who lost 91 pounds between May 22 and July 14. It wasn't just the males who could drop or add pounds. One sow, weighing 263 pounds, was captured a year later with three cubs and weighed in at 147. The caloric requirements of feeding three cubs was no doubt the main factor in this loss of 116 pounds. Unlike most humans, black bears are polygamous, with females able to breed with several males each breeding season. DNA tests show a litter of cubs can have different fathers. After the breeding season is over, males and females go their separate ways and live solitary lives. An unusual adaptation in bears is that after the egg is fertilized, it goes into what is called delayed implantation for around 6 months. In the deep of winter, late January or early February, while the female is sleeping in the den, the eggs will implant and the fetus starts to grow. If the female is not healthy enough in winter, for example, having low body weight, the eggs may not implant and develop, but be absorbed by the female's body to protect her survival. If the female is healthy, cubs develop and are born hairless and only weigh about 8 ounces. The average litter size is 3, but 4 is common, and many cases of 5 have been documented. Over the years, I worked assisting Dr. Ray Anderson of the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point and his graduate students who were studying black bear ecology, which took me into dozens of winter bear dens. We started the denning work in March when the cubs were around 5 pounds and fully furred. We needed to replace the collar batteries on the bears because they would only transmit for 1 year. The dens varied somewhat in size and configuration. Some were over 6 feet below ground. A couple were high in tree cavities, and others were nothing more than shallow scrapes or depressions on the ground. One time we found a den right on the top of the ground in a shallow nest made from spruce branches. In the scraped-out area that formed this den were 3 healthy cubs. Bear dens are always neat and clean, and the nest bowl is lined with grasses. Most of the bear dens were so inconspicuous we never would have found them without the radio collar signal. The collar technology included a waterproof transmitter, batteries, and an antenna that sends a signal to a handheld or vertical-mounted receiver. The signal has a set frequency that becomes louder as a researcher gets closer to the animal. Our tracking method was to use the antenna, a map, and simple geometry to get a basic location for the collared animal by driving roads in the target area and stopping every half mile or so until a beep signal is picked up from the collar. Once the signal is steady, the antenna is pointed in the direction of the strongest and loudest signal beep, a compass bearing is taken, and a line is marked on a topographic map connecting the antenna location following the degree line of the compass. Then the researcher drives to a second location, perhaps a half mile away, where a signal is detected, takes a bearing, and plots a second line. The point where the two lines intersect gives the animal's approximate location. If more details on location are desired, or a den needs to be found, the researcher takes a handheld antenna and follows the signal on foot. The beep-beep signal gets louder, and once the transmitter collar is very close, it thumps loudly, allowing the animal or its den location to be found. In theory, it is easy, but there are complications. If an animal is underground, the signal can be muffled. If there are hills blocking the signals or making them bounce, that can be a problem too. Sometimes the animal is in a location too far from a road for a signal to be picked up. In that case, budget allowing, airplanes can be called in to fly a grid over the suspected area. Even then, something can go amiss. Sometimes we would be standing right on top of the den with the bear directly below us and not know it. With persistence, we usually were able to find our bear, and then the exciting part of the job would begin. I was often the one to crawl in to either administer the tranquilizer or take den measurements, ostensibly because of my smaller size at 5'8". If the bear was asleep, it was easy. That is, if you think working your way into a snow-covered hole in the ground is easy. If they were awake, it could get your adrenaline going. One time in the late 1970s, Jack Koch, the wildlife technician at Park Falls, darted a bear in its den, and unbeknownst to him, the dart failed to go off. After waiting for the drug to do its work, Jack started back down the den entrance, only to be met by a very excited bear trying to come out. Jack scrambled backwards, and luckily he had another dart handy. As the bear charged out of the den, Jack made an excellent shot at the running bear, and it soon wobbled to a halt. We re-collared that bear and carefully pushed and pulled him back into the den. Later, Jack surmised that the first dart failed because it was in his outside pocket and had frozen. Another peculiarity of bears is that sows allow yearling young to winter in the den with them, and collaring all of them could be quite challenging, especially near the end of the denning season if the weather got warm and the bears were active. Male yearlings can weigh 75 pounds, with females topping out at around 60. When an adult sow with three yearlings were all jammed in the den together, we had our hands full getting them all tranquilized and sorted out. We would go for the sow first, then block off the entrance and take on the yearlings one at a time. A syringe pole and a flashlight were the best tools, and I was often the flashlight guy. The dens with newborn cubs were the most fun because the cubs didn't bite. We put them inside our parkas against our bodies to keep them warm. This was the only time cubs were fun to handle. They were like puppies. The DNR learned a lot from the cub den studies. Productivity and mortality rates were important to our black bear population model, as we didn't want to harvest more bears during hunting season than were produced. We rarely found fewer yearlings in the den than cubs the year before, suggesting survival was usually good. I think this is because black bears are good mothers and are very protective. We also felt we had good habitat with plenty of food. Generally, that means our bears go into dens with lots of stored fat, and essential for surviving the 6 to 7 month winter fast, and for females carrying the extra energy burden of producing milk for the cubs. I only remember one bear that starved during the winter. It was a female on Stockton Island in Ashland County, and the island's acorn crop had failed that year. The islands had mostly mature forest with poor forage for bears, which meant the Apostle Island bears often had low body weights with little stored fat when entering their dens. Bears have quite a reputation with the public as both a dangerous and charismatic species, and when you work with bears, you have to deal with these stereotypes. If I mentioned to people that I handled bears, their eyes would widen, and they would expect some hair-raising story. Quite the contrary to this image, black bears are relatively easy to work with. Although they are rarely seen by the public, they can be captured with little trouble if you provide the right incentive, i.e. food. The black bear is a large, robust animal, and as such, it can wear a radio telemetry collar with little risk to its health and survival. Acquiring data, such as productivity, is relatively easy. You simply follow their radio signals to their den and count them as they conveniently go to sleep for the winter. Though there have been a few dramatic instances where a bear caused my heart to race, I also spent many routine hours collecting data on bears and learning from my research colleagues who did the hard work studying their ecology. In the end, all the hours and analysis by university researchers and DNR field biologists helped Wisconsin maintain a sustainable population of bears and balance the needs of bears and humans. Of course, for me, it added an element of challenge and excitement to my career. I'll stop there. I wanted to tell you a little more about Terry Dalton and her artwork in this book. She's an environmental educator and artist. She works in scratchboard, watercolor, pastels, and printmaking. Her artwork can be viewed at terrydaltonart.com. Her last name is spelled D-A-U-L-T-O-N. Her illustrations are so evocative and lovely. And Jeff Wilson currently spends his time between his island cabin on the Turtle Flambeau Flowage and Lake Superior, adventuring with his wife, artist, and illustrator Terry Dalton. Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology, is his first full-length book, and I'm so glad that they combined their lives and created this wonderful memoir of their adventures. On the back of the book, Tia Nelson, daughter of Gaylord Nelson, says, "An illuminating and entertaining journey of inquiry into the wonders of nature." Next week, we will be learning much more about osprey and the efforts to increase their numbers in the state. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.